read with our perspectives and our prejudices and our traditions, and we fail to read other things, or we wipe out things that we read that we disagree with. Let me read it again. We read what we can bear to read. We hear what is tolerable to hear. We evade or spiritualize those parts that leave us uncomfortable, if not outraged. Check it out for yourself. Whether it's in theology or pedagogy or even gerontology or sociology or psychology or psychoanalytical thought or methods of writing poetry, we tend to go with our own school or our own traditions and rule the rest out. Now, the Holy Spirit moves in mysterious ways. Yesterday, I was reading a photography magazine. And believe it or not, this quotation fits those quotations and what I'm going to do today. And the last part of it is almost in the style of Luther. There will be no end of making pictures, some with hands concealed, some with hands revealed, and some without hands. But we should make the distinction, while it is still clear, between the photograph that mirror the subject and images that reveal the photographer. One is intrinsically photographic, the other is not. Stiglitz arranged Georgie O'Keeffe, an unadorned person, part of nature. We see her as a composition, a Stiglitz arrangement. Only the photographer, not the camera, could make something synthetic out of this subject. Another Stiglitz photograph, captioned Spiritual America, shows the rear quarter of a horse with a harness. Is this a photograph of a horse or of the photographer? I think we need to recognize that. You know, there are theologians and there are theologians, there are horses' asses and there are horses' heads. And we sometimes confuse the issue by riding our own horse, hearing with our own words. Now, before I really begin the details on this, I want to give some of you a chance to pick up with some terminology and then a little bit of yesterday's lecture and then move on. First of all, some people asked me yesterday, what's the word eschatology mean? And I was throwing around with my jargon yesterday. Eschatology is a popular word, especially with the Pentecostals and the Orthodox. It isn't too popular with most Lutherans, although we teach it in seminaries and some of your pastors teach it, and the third article of the Creed talks about it. The word eschaton merely means the end or the last things. Death, resurrection, judgment, heaven, hell, purgatory, limbo, how you got put together or how you get recreated, all those little things about what's going on. And eschatology is merely like theology, sociology, psychological. It's a study of or a word about the last things. And then you get the word doxology and orthodoxy. Now, orthodoxy is the word we use so often, and it really means correct teaching. That's the literal meaning. But the Orthodox themselves don't agree with that. It's correct living. That's the way they take the word. Correct living. So that we're doing that. Now we Lutherans, when we try to say we want the whole thing, we use the word that the Greeks would have used called orthopraxis, which means correct practice. It's the same word as practice. So we want to recognize that they're using a broader word than when we do it. When the Missouri Synod talks about orthodoxy, they're talking about dogma. They're talking about theological principles, logical and irrational principles at times, but they're talking about those. When we talk about an ecumenical movement, as we talked about it last night, and I talked about it a little bit yesterday because the Cyprus seminar at the 1st of August was an ecumenical seminar at a retreat center that was started by Archbishop Makarios. And we were a bunch of people of various denominations, including the Greek Orthodox themselves. We had an Episcopalian bishop and we had an Orthodox bishop. Lutheran bishops never think they have to learn anything more. They're always giving it out, so there weren't any Lutheran bishops there. But we need to stop and look at the word. Ecumenical, let's start down here. Ecumenical is a simple word that we use about the ecumenical movement, ecumenical relations among denominations and among church families, and so on. You may not know it's related to economics. The study of economics has something to do with ecumenical. It has nothing to do with whether they gave $75,000 to the Popular Front or not, Arnie, but it plays into it. Because all three of these words come from the original word oikos in Greek, which means house, home, or household. And so when you see oikomene, it means what pertains to the household. And in the early Roman Empire, before the Christian period, the inhabitable unbarbarian world was the oikomene, the oikomenos of the Roman Empire, the family of us under the Roman emperor. You follow what they're saying? It was a family. And so when the ecumenical movement talks about oikomeno, and on the Cyprus Retreat Center, they've got the World Council of Churches seal and this word on it. And many people wonder what it is. It merely says the household or the family of God. And that's the issue we talked about yesterday. The issue that worship is the gathering of the family of God to go up, to be with God, to celebrate the resurrection, the transfiguration, the ascension, and the eschaton, to bring that all together. It's a family worship that's brought together at one time in the oikomene. Now, the freedom to go, the freedom to come, the freedom to move around in church, the freedom to suckle children in church. In the Nicaea Cathedral 4 weeks ago, I had a little girl playing around my feet the whole first hour. She was crawling around on the floor, and her mother was back a while from. She didn't worry about where the girl was. If this had happened in St. Paul or Hope in Toledo, the mother would have been scrambling up the aisle trying to pull her out from under my pew or wherever I was if the little girl started doing that, because you'd be disturbing. But no, this was just part of the nature of the thing, that the little girl was crawling around and enjoying her life. So the freedom for mothers and children, the freedom for coming and going at any time in the service is there. So it's an oikomene. It's a family. It's a worship of the people of God who've come up together. Now, if that's true, we have some things that are going to deal with the whole business of infant communion in a moment. Let's sum it up by quoting another one of my favorite Orthodox theologians in the United States, Floreschi. Floreschi is at St. Vladimir's along with Schmemann. And by the way, the only book on my bibliography that's here is an old book by Schmemann for the Life of the World. There are two copies, one in the Circulation Library and one in the Koinonia Reserve Library. And you'll get a feeling for it, although this is a limited thing because it was done for the Christian student movement back in the 50s. But it's an excellent book. Floreschi's my other favorite besides Schmemann. Some of you who've been talking about red books, green books, and other things might listen to this. Because if worship is what ordains faith, informs faith, and forms faith, then a change in liturgy is changing your theology. It's changing your faith. Whether you want it changed or not is part of the issue, isn't it? Now, and who gets the right to tell you it ought to be changed? Quote, Christianity is a liturgical religion. Note that word. It's not an intellectual religion. It's not an emotional religion. It's not a philosophical religion. It's a liturgical religion. The church is first of all a worshiping community. Worship comes first. Doctrine and discipline are second. That's a shocker for many of us, because we think catechism and the Book of Concord come first, or the Westminster or the Heidelberg Confession come first. And then we try to figure out some kind of worship that'll make sense with those confessions. Repeat that sentence. Worship comes first, doctrine and discipline second. And that's the end of the quote, but the next paragraph, I paraphrase in one sentence. Filareski says, if you want to get the faith, attend the liturgy, don't read a book. Now that's the very opposite, you know. We tell you, here's this book. If you're a Methodist and you want to become a Lutheran, read the Catechism, read this book, come to this class, we'll teach you all there is to know about Lutheranism. No, we won't. We'll teach you all the head can tell you about Lutheranism. But as Ed Schramm said this morning, there's a lot of gut, there's a lot of colitis in Lutheranism and in Luther. There's a lot of stuff going on that's more than just head learning. So, Dr. Schramm this morning said that this is a controversial subject. Everything I'm going to talk about is a controversial subject. That's the only reason I'm talking about it, because I love to talk about controversial subjects. And just the plain Eastern Orthodox Church is a controversial subject when you start thinking of their worship. And now the LCA especially is in tension. Back in 1970, some of you recall, and some of your congregations opted for it and some didn't, that the LCA and the ALC, that's the Lutheran Church in America, and the American Lutheran Church, for those of you who are not Lutheran, that alphabet soup that Roosevelt got us into, I got to explain every now and then, they decided for some reason or other that maybe we ought to have communion before confirmation, and maybe it could go back to as early as the fifth grade. And therefore it wasn't completely dependent upon confirmation instruction before you could have communion. For some reason or other, they picked me as one of the guys to go around certain parts of Texas and other parts of the country to explain this kind of change, because it is a change. It's a liturgical change. It's a theological change. It's a psychological and pedagogical change. So we went around explaining how it was that for Luther's day, it was neither condemned nor was it affirmed. And so it was optional. Another great big code word that Lutherans like to use is adiaphora. That means it's a matter of indifference. Who cares whether you do it or don't do it? So in the 15th and 16th centuries, infant communion for Lutherans was adiaphora, a matter of indifference, although very few people did it. It was not related to confirmation in those days either. Because we were growing out of the Catholic Church, you remember. And the funny thing that's happening is we're going to pass each other. You know, the Catholics are now pushing away First Communion from kindergarten and first grade and making it later. And we're gradually pushing First Communion down to the fifth grade. And maybe we'll push it down to infants if we follow what I'm talking about today. But way back in 1962, before that trial thing, and just get a hand here. How many of your congregations allow people from the fifth grade up, with parents' permission and the children's option, to commune in the fifth or sixth grade before confirmation? Okay, most of you have taken the option. Are any of the congregations who took the other option, which again, it's adiaphora, it's a matter of indifference, how many of you, communion comes after confirmation? None of us here? Okay, so you all got converted by a new liturgical form that allowed for this to happen. Changed your faith, really, if you'd admit it. Because does a fifth grader know as much as an adult confirmand, or a 14 or 15 or a high school confirmand? Is knowledge therefore involved, or isn't it involved? What are we talking about? There are two statements. One goes back as far as 1962, and I'm getting to the Orthodox eventually, but I want to set the theme as to why the argument right now. In 1962, the LCA put out a statement, and they agreed on it in convention. The prerequisite for admission to the Lord's Supper is not confirmation, but baptism. And in the pastor's desk book copy of the New Green Hymnal, Lutheran Book of Worship, on page 31, it says, the gift of communion is the birthright of the baptized. Now, you know, that's as plain as the nose on my face. And some of you have even bigger noses than I do. So, you know, it's obvious that theologically, baptism admits you to communion. But we've stopped it at either high school, or junior high school, or fifth or sixth grade. Now, what's happened is, but Gettysburg was mentioned, a couple of people were communing children, infants in arms even, at the Gettysburg Seminary. And last year, the LCA decided, although they had said they were going to study it, they didn't study it, they came out with a fiat that said, that shall not be done. So now there's the big issue going on. Are these professors supposed to be excommunicated for doing it? One of them says, I won't do it anymore. The other one says, I won't do it anymore here. But the other people, or both of these men, are saying, you've excommunicated all these children. You see, practice is faith. And if they've been communing these children, just as the argument was against the 1970 idea about communion in the fifth grade, people said, well, what if they get communed in the fifth or sixth grade in St. Paul's and they move to Minneapolis and the congregation doesn't commune children? What kind of a orderly and decent process will go on? It really hasn't caused any trouble. It was a red flag, a red herring that people were flying around trying to say it's going to cause us trouble. Maybe the other wouldn't either. Now, Lutherans up until two centuries ago, as well as the Orthodox, some Episcopalians, many Roman Catholics, had a rite which is not in our hymnal anymore, and I don't want to put it back. It was called the churching of women. Now, sexist language is there, let's admit it. And many people don't want to think of the reason why they were churching women, about the uncleanness of sex and childbirth and the blood and all that sort of thing. But the churching of women program in the Lutheran and the Orthodox both, if you go back historically, had two statements in the prayers, the churching of women. I'll tell you why they had churching first in a moment. One was, we pray that these will now be numbered in the chosen flock. That's before baptism. The baby and the mother are numbered in the chosen flock in the service of the churching of women. And then listen to the next one. This is a very important one. That none, they pray, that none may remain unrejected and will be united in due time to the Holy Church. Sorry, I've written that wrong. That none will remain rejected and will be united in due time to the Holy Church. Do you follow what they're saying? They're saying the churching of the woman and the baby after childbirth brought them into the church as part of the family. The family of God that we talked about yesterday at worship. Now, all of that was reaffirmed, believe it or not, by what many Lutherans call a reactionary group, the Council of Church, the Council of Trent. They were responsible for reaffirming the fact that in 1200 AD, the Roman Catholic Church stopped baptizing and communing infants at the same time, putting the two things together. I'm just going to read a summary real quickly here to get that out of the way and then move up to something that gets us into the subject we're on. Research on infant communion in the history of the church has clearly demonstrated a well-established practice in the patristic age, 200 to 600 AD, and its continuation in the Western Church until the jurisdiction of Rome, until the 13th century, ending about 1200. Significant church fathers such as Cyprian and Augustine regarded infant communion as an integral part of the life of the church based upon the mandate of the Johannine Jesus in John 6:53, which we just heard about in all the Gospels for the last 5 weeks. If you do not eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you will not have life in yourself. Some of the early church fathers criticized the custom of infant communion, but its standard practice in the patristic age cannot be denied. Now, this moves us right in to the issue of the Eastern Orthodox. And that's this next little group of words. The Eastern Orthodox do not talk about sacraments. They do not talk about sacramentals. They do not talk about rites. They talk about the divine liturgy and the mysteries. And tomorrow I'll spend a lot more time on this, but nowhere until after the Council of Trent did they even count how many mysteries there were. The number is anywhere from 2 to 14. 2 to 14 sacraments, if you want to use that word. That's the wrong word. That's a Latin word that has some problems for us because we work about 2 sacraments, although Luther had 4. We work with Catholics who have 7 and Episcopalian high churches who have 7, and we worry about that. The number 7 never got into the Eastern Church at all until after the Reformation. And then they started talking about the 7 a little bit. But most of the time they were talking about mysteries that were not numbered. The number of the mysteries, the number of the liturgies, the number of the rites, the number of the sacramentals and sacraments, if you want to use those terms, depends on God's grace, not on age or IQ. The effectiveness of a mystery is a mystery because it's God's gift, not man's doing, not what I know or what I do. One of the things Father Joseph, who's the priest of St. Elias Syrian Orthodox Church in Toledo, he and I are good friends, and he gave me a few books to read, and we sit and chat on the differences. And this is as fairly good a quote as I can give from him about this whole issue. He says, "Since communion is not an obligation put on people, it is normal and natural for everybody to receive." You see, if you have an obligation in the Catholic Church for once a year, or if in the ALC or the LCA, you got to commune at least once every 2 years, or they call you inactive, they can't take away your baptism, but they can take away your active status in some constitutional ideas. And if no confession of sins, now this is important. Remember yesterday I said they cut down the confession of sins? If no confession of sins is required, you don't even have to be able to talk, do you, to receive communion. You just have to be able to suck. And I say that deliberately because for some Eastern Orthodox priests, if the baby is too small to even take the sock dipped in the wine, they'll dip their finger in the wine and let the baby suck the finger. And most babies of any age can suck my finger, just as they can suckle a mother's breast or a bottle. And so that's important. It is normal and natural. Since there's no introspection required, if you understand Paul rightly, you know, let a man examine himself and so let him eat and drink. But what's he examining himself about? We think it's about the mystery, transubstantiation, the real presence. What is a real sacrament? Do I have the faith? Have I had enough remorse? Have I repented? Do I do all the right things now? And am I coming in the right spirit with my neighbor? Have I forgiven my neighbor before I come to the altar? But if the body of Christ in Paul means the family of Christ, the Christian church, when does a child not be aware of belonging to a family? Never. In the Hebrew tradition, the mother bore the child and the father immediately picked it up, salted it down, and the child knew. And as the child is embraced, as the child is nursed, that child is always a member of the family. When did I become aware that I was a member of the Carl George Wolf family? I have no memory of that. I always was a member of the Carl George Wolf family, okay? Can any of you point to a point in time, unless you were adopted, but if you were a natural born child of natural parents, can you point to a moment in your life and say, "Oh gee, now I'm a wolf"? I don't think you can. And that's part of the issue, you see. If we don't need introspection that I'm now a member of the Christ, if I don't need to intellectually catalog my venial or my mortal or my immortal sins, why do I have to be of a certain age? Well, it's rather interesting about this. You see, confession in the Catholic Church and in the Orthodox Church, when it's used in the Orthodox at all, doesn't begin till about age 7. But communion has been going on since at least age 3, and I'll tell you why 3 is mentioned in a moment. Because you don't have to have all of this. Now, why did we change it to 5th grade? I think the rationale that I used and the books used, I think Kloss was the man who wrote the book that we used as a guideline, was using that this is the new psychology, that we now know a little bit about child growth and child psychology and education, so that the 5th grade is a time when people are ready to be part of the church. They can understand a little bit of the concepts. They're beginning to be intellectual. They're beginning to be rational. They're no longer believing in Santa Claus. That happened in the 2nd and 3rd grade when they changed from the distinction between fact and fiction, or myth and reality as we sometimes use it. Mutually related to the family is the important issue. If we separate out our various definitions of who's a child, we'd come up with all kinds of things, wouldn't we? For army, it's 18, and for voting in some states, it's 18. Michigan just changed their drinking law from 18 to 21 because they saw too many 19-year-olds cracking up in automobiles. There are other excuses. 16 in some places. Now many school boards are saying, let's don't make it a law that you keep children in school till they're 18, because by 18 they're big enough to kill the teachers or rape them. So let's get them out by 16. I know some 16-year-olds who still do that too. But, you know, we're trying to figure that. When is a child an infant? When is he an adult? 7 years, 3 years, 5th grade, junior high, high school, 18, 21. And when, and this is the other period I'm now a specialist in, when do I start getting into second childhood? And when do you start calling me a babe in arms again? And when do I, as a pastor, decide this saint that's 85, who's had a stroke, can't make a decent confession, can't examine himself, so the hell with him, I won't give him communion? Now, if we're going to be consistent, that's what we've got to say. Because if you've got to make a rational confession, if you've got to be able to examine yourself, if you've got to be able to talk to the priest or the pastor in order to get it before age 10 or 12, what about after age 60, 80, 90, or 100? Well, what about the people in the middle who get cracked up in an automobile accident and go into a coma for a number of weeks or months? Do we pastorally say, since you can't examine yourself, you're no longer a member of the family of God? Do the people who love that husband or wife, that child, do they say, now that you're in a coma, you don't belong to us anymore? You're not part of the family? We may not feed you the same liver and onions that we gave you before, but we're going to see that you get some nourishment and sustenance. So part of the issue is, who is an adult? Who is an infant? And if you define that by rationality, you'll come down where the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics come down. If you define it on the basis of who's a member of the family, not who's an adult, you'll come down with the Eastern Orthodox and some of the LCA people who are in trouble because they commune infants. Now, we got to really deal with the Near Eastern way of doing things. And I'm not going to use the word Orthodox anymore. I'll use it occasionally because I'll slip. But even the in 1959, because the ecumenical movement was coming along so well, the Patriarch of Constantinople, who's the equivalent in a way of honor to the Pope of Rome in the Eastern churches, said that those non-Orthodox, non-Chalcedonian Eastern churches were all Orthodox. All the heresy that had been talked about for 1,500 years was eliminated by one statement. So they're Eastern churches, if you want to do it that way. Now, one thing you maybe don't know is that when they ultimately baptize, three things take place at the same time. Forget the churching of the women, I'll get that into the picture again. First, you baptize. At the same ceremony, you seal them with the sign of the cross. At the same ceremony, you anoint them with oil, which is called chrismation. And for us, chrismation is the equivalent of confirmation. Now, they don't use the word confirmation in the East. But when they try to communicate to Lutherans and Catholics, they say chrismation, the sign of the cross and the oil, is the equivalent of confirmation. Same rite, same time as baptism is normally done. Now, the relationship. Most Eastern children, Orthodox or non-Chalcedonian or what have you, are baptized no later than 3 years of age. Now you might ask, how come that happens? Well, it happens because baptism is usually done at either Easter or Pentecost, only once a year in most churches, sometimes not often that often. In some of the families of the Orthodox in the East and the non-Orthodox in the East, the bishop is required for baptisms. And just as in the Catholic Church they don't confirm every year because the bishop can't get around every place every year, so they might be as long as 3 years till a baby is baptized. But when he's baptized, he belongs to the family of God. He's been sealed with the sign of the cross. He's been anointed with oil. And he's a member of the laos, the people of God, the family of God. He's a member of the oikomene, the oikos of God. I recommend this for your church libraries. Author Carl Peepcorn, one of the very fine scholars in the Missouri Church who died a few years ago, his book is being published out, a series of books is being published posthumously, but it's called Profiles in Belief. And the first volume is on the Roman Catholic and the Orthodox. And this is his sentence about the Orthodox way. Immediately after receiving baptism and chrismation, the new member, again regardless of age, receives Holy Communion. This is for all of these churches. A Lutheran who writes about the Orthodox, listen to the language. Remember what I said about McAfee Brown? We hear what we want to hear. We listen to what we want to listen. Listen to the funny word that this guy stuck in, a good Lutheran theologian writing on the history of the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Orthodox Church generously. Listen to that. That's an interesting word he puts in. He puts a value judgment. The Orthodox Church generously admits even small children to communion after their baptism and chrismation, thus making them table companions of the resurrected Lord. That ties over correctly with yesterday, you recall? We're in the banquet feasts after the resurrection. We're celebrating on the eighth day, not the first or the seventh day. So in a wedding banquet, when my children were married and we had a sort of a wedding reception, did we tell the little kids who were there, you can't go up and have any wedding cake? Did we tell the little kids who were there, you can't go up and have the punch, whether it was spiked or not spiked? We might have decided you can't have the spiked punch, but that's a matter of our own value system. We didn't keep them out, did we? And I've seen mothers nursing children at wedding receptions, taking a little of that nice icing off the wedding cake and letting the child nibble it because it was part of the family celebration. It was right there. The infant, you see, needed to worship as a family. Let me read you another quotation, and then I'm going to go back to someone else. This is Timothy Ware, whose book I recommended yesterday to Professor Munson as the best book on the Orthodox that you can get. And you can find it in most university libraries, university bookstores. It's a Pelican book. It's just called The Orthodox Church by Timothy Ware. Now, he is a Westerner who was converted and changed to the Eastern Orthodox. So he's coming as a convert and telling you about what he's learned. And sometimes the convert sees things like I'm seeing things, that the people who grow up into it don't always see it. As soon as possible after chrismation, an Orthodox child is brought to communion. Watch this one, because I talked about becoming a wolf, you remember? His earliest memories of the church will center on the act of receiving the holy gifts of Christ's body and blood. Communion is not something to which he comes at the age of 6 or 7 or in adolescence, but something from which he has never been excluded. I was never excluded from the Wolf family. Oh, my father would send me up without my dessert sometimes upstairs, mm-hmm. but I knew I was still part of the family, even when I was upstairs in semi-isolation. I was never aware of a time when I wasn't a wolf. Okay? Now I'm going to ask you to communicate with me on one little thing. If you don't do it, I'll do it for you, but I think it'll be fun. We're going to look at baptism first, because this is tied up with baptism, and some of you do what's known as force field. It's plus or minus. Just call out. We won't debate them. We won't argue them. What are the reasons why some Baptists say you shouldn't baptize children below a certain age, the age of rationality, around 15, 16? Why do Lutherans and Episcopalians and Roman Catholics say we baptize infants? Let's just give it real quick so we don't get lost here on time.
Cannot believe.
They can't believe. That's a minus. Okay. Another one quick.
God's grace.
God's grace is a plus, I think you're saying, right? To receive God's grace, the child is still given. Okay, any others?
Not knowledgeable.
Not knowledgeable. They can't talk, they can't tell things about what they're doing, okay? Anything else?
They haven't reached the age of understanding.
All right, not at the age of understanding. Okay, any others?
These little ones who believe in me.
All right. Little ones believe in me, Jesus said. Whether you believe it or not, is possible. How about another one that we use in the Lutheran Church, especially in Episcopal and Roman Catholic Church, out of the Book of Acts and other places about children? I'll put it up real quick.
Baptize whole families.
Whole families, thanks, Ed. Whole families, and that includes slaves as well as infants. Whole families were communed. The other side of that is no mention specifically in Acts of children. But that's an argument from silence. It doesn't say, and they baptized Mary and John and 16 little kids. Doesn't say that. They just said Mary and John and the whole family. That's really. Any others you want to put up? I think we ought to can't make confession. Can't confess, and that goes two ways. They can't confess faith or sin. That's why we have parents and godparents, right? They make the confession of both getting rid of the devil and saying, I believe in the Apostles' Creed. So they can't do that. Any other pluses? That's good enough. We could do more on this. I could fill it up. I've got a chart here I could fill up, but you did it. Now, what you've just done is not baptism at all. You've done it on infant communion. Dirty trick I played on you. But every argument for or against infant communion can be used against infant baptism. In other words, infant baptism, it's God's grace. It's God's table. They trust and they believe. Maybe they don't understand, but they trust and they believe. And they're part of the family of God and part of the others. On the other hand, the people argue, they can't really believe intellectually. They can only trust. My illustration of trust, by the way, and then I'll sit down, is when my kids were between 1 and 4, I could throw them up in the air or tell them to jump off there and I'd catch them. And they'd trust this dumb guy. They'd assume I could catch them. Once they got to be about 6 or 7, they began to have some doubts. They didn't have any trust in this old guy. You know, either they thought I was too feeble, or they were too fat, or just, you know, he might do like Lucy does in the Peanuts strip. He might just step aside and let the football come down there. You know, that's it. But they can believe, they can trust, as long as we don't insist that belief means understanding. Not knowledgeable, not understanding. No mention specifically that they were communed. You know, it says the breaking of bread and communion and the first day of the week and all that sort of thing, but doesn't say kids. And they can't confess faith or sin. So what you've just done, every argument that the Baptists use against our infant baptism has been used by Lutherans and Roman Catholics against infant communion. And every argument for infant baptism that Lutherans, Catholics, and Episcopalians use can be used by Lutherans, if they want to, and Orthodox and Easterners for infant communion. You follow what we're talking about? See that little bind we're in? If by baptism I become a member of the family, if it's God's grace, if it doesn't require understanding, it ought to be open for everyone who's involved. Now, up until 1970, we in the Lutheran Church talked primarily about the ability to confess sin or faith, which is over there. And that's why we said, well, maybe by the time of the fifth grade, they can do that. We don't have to wait till adolescence for that. The reason for adolescence, by the way, as a dividing point, was because of the bar mitzvah of the old Jewish law. Bar mitzvah meant that by the time you were 12 or 13, you became responsible for your own actions and not daddy and mama. And so when I go to a bar mitzvah service in one of the three synagogues in Toledo, and the man gets up, who is a man now at 12, he's saying, I'm taking moral responsibility for my life under God as well as under the laws of the land. I'm now that, and it's not my father anymore. So that's where it came. It came to moral responsibility. Not many children under 12 can commit adultery. There are a few who can. They can be harassed. They can be sexually assaulted. And that's another issue about families and about present-day sexism and so on. But the moral issue. A child of 5, 6, or 7 who picks things up isn't necessarily stealing. When I used to, I told some of you yesterday, I used to do talks about children. I used to say that when people got to kindergarten and you saw them fighting over toys, anything that isn't nailed down or held by somebody else is mine. That's the definition of private property. At age 5 or 6, you know, if it isn't in somebody else's hands or nailed down, it's mine. And you know, that's not a moral issue. They can't confess I stole Bobby's toy when I took the little ducky. No, I didn't steal Bobby's toy. Bobby's toy wasn't Bobby's toy because Bobby wasn't playing with it. It wasn't tacked down, didn't have his name on it. It's mine. It's mine to pick up. So the bar mitzvah and the bat mitzvah, which is the female version of the confirmation that the Reformed Jews talk about, talks about the age of discretion. The age of moral responsibility, the age of becoming a man. And in Yiddish, they use the old German word, you know, he's a kleiner Mensch. He's a Mensch. He's a kleiner Mensch. And the word Mensch is really meant like a full-grown, responsible human being. And that's significant. Now, if intellectual life is there, what are we going to discuss? Are we going to set up in the Lutheran Church, as the Catholic Church has, as the Episcopal Church has, as most of the people in the West have since the Renaissance and the Enlightenment both, they both contributed to this, quote, heresy, unquote, are we going to set up rational, cognitive norms, or are we going to accept the love and the grace of God, which sets no norms? There are no norms for God's love to you. He loves the publican. He loved, as Ed said, the harlot. He loved the people who were the sinners. He didn't set a norm that if you behave so, I'll love you. Or if you can understand so much, I'll love you. I wonder if maybe we don't make God less than a pastor. many pastors deal with various sins, various traumas, in a pastoral style of theology, not in a jurisprudent idea, not in a legalistic, moralistic point of view. There's still a few pastors who maybe say, you did that, therefore you take 30 lashes, but most of them don't. Most are talking about trying to see how we can change that, how we can realize that God still loves you even though you've been a thief, an embezzler. God still loves you even though you've gotten a divorce or you've committed adultery. God still loves you, and the reassurance that comes from that. And we very seldom keep, even though I think it's still in the ALC Constitution, and my congregation got balled up by my student Bob Marshall for having a constitution that eliminated the excommunication paragraph. We have no discipline paragraph in Hope Lutheran Church to say that people are going to be excluded because of this. Who's the judge? Just because that one became public, we judge that one? And these people who are better Nixonites, who know how to cover up their adultery, their murder, and embezzlement better, are they the ones that we're going to let take communion? No, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And I don't think a discipline and excommunication statement belongs in a church constitution. But that's just one man's opinion. Okay, let's move to another issue now. Who can judge how we can do the body of Christ, how we can witness to the body of Christ? If the Orthodox Church, and last night Arnie mentioned it, when the Orthodox Church joined the World Council of Churches, it more than doubled in size, right? It more than doubled in size. And if more than half of the World Council of Churches baptizes infants and communes infants, what are we saying about the family of Christ? And even some of the people who don't belong to the Council of Churches, the black and the white primitive Baptists, the black and the white free will Baptists, all commune children. They also do foot washing, by the way, which we'll get to tomorrow as another issue. What do we say to the ecumenical witness in the world when we say you have to be 12, or you have to be 10, or you have to have passed the fifth grade, or you have to not be senile in order to get the grace of God? What are we saying to our common witness? Now, in the 13th century, this stopped in the West. Why did it stop? It stopped because between the 12th and the 13th century, some other practices that Lutherans don't believe in, at least most of them don't believe in, started getting into Western Catholicism. Namely, the reserved host. Namely, the adored host. Namely, the reconsecrated, transubstantiated host. And when you get blood and wine, it's no longer blood and wine, and can be reserved, then you need some kind of intellectual discernment and decision-making about what's going on. Then confession got tied. In the West, it wasn't tied until the late Middle Ages. Confession wasn't tied to communion. Even now, you know, the obligation is not once a year communion in the Catholic Church. It's once a year confession. You can take the Eucharist every Sunday or every day in the year. You don't have to make confession. It's only Lutherans who try to tie confession to that. Confession was tied to a required age of discretion because you knew what you were. And then there came this thing I just talked about, excommunication. The power of the priest who could perform such miracles of transubstantiation had the right to say, you can't have my little goodies. You can't take what I've just changed because I'm the host at this banquet. And Lutherans have objected to reservation of the hosts, transubstantiation, adored host, and that the priest or the pastor does the job on the bread and the wine. So why should we be hung up by using all the arguments of the 13th and 14th century? Essentially, you see, in that period, Communion was tied to cognitive, rational abilities and nothing else. It was mainly to protect the transubstantiated host. Infant communion, then, in the LCA last year, was said to be precluded. I think I heard Vern Rieke say yesterday in the norm situation that some people think norms are decided by majority vote. Is doctrine decided by majority vote? Should liturgy be divided by majority vote? If so, we never had a green hymnal. We never would have, you know, because that wasn't a majority vote of all the congregations or even all the members of all the congregations. It was a vote of some other special people. If infant communion is condemned, then what do we do with those Methodist LCAs who still have grape juice? What do we do with those people who, like my father's church, Ed, where Ed now is, don't have weekly Eucharists?
Don't have what?
Don't have weekly Eucharists. Eucharists offered all the time. If unity of the church is the family of God, and that includes the Orthodox, then the phrase that the LCA used, infant communion is precluded in the church. Whoever said the LCA or the ALC was the church? They at least should have cleaned up their language in the LCA and said infant communion is precluded in the Lutheran Church in America. That would have at least been an honest statement. But to say it's precluded in the church is just plain silly. Church can't be LCA only. Can't be Lutherans only. It's the oikumeno. I'm sorry I erased that. It's the whole thing. Then the final statement, then I'm going to read a quotation, then let you talk if you want to. Are the sacraments necessary for salvation? That's a statement and question that's been asked ever since before the time of Luther, and Lutherans answer it since then. The Small Catechism by Luther, Edmund Schlink, who's one of the great German theologians of the 20th century, all agree that the sacraments are necessary for salvation. But neither the Small Catechism, nor the Large Catechism, nor any of the volumes Edmund Schlink ever wrote deals with the infant problem. If the sacraments, plural, are necessary for salvation, who's in the LCAs to go damn all those children between age 1 and the 5th grade? Now, that's an exaggerated statement, isn't it? We really don't do that, because we ultimately backtrack a little bit and we say, you know, we can't judge, and if they don't get the sacraments because of some pastor's fault or because the parents' fault or because of some LCA rule, then we allow the grace of God to operate. But you know when we allow the grace of God to operate? When our rules don't work. We ought to let the grace of God operate before we start setting our rules up. The grace of God is prior to our ecumenical or ecclesiastical or denominational or local congregational laws and constitutions. And I'm going to talk briefly about it tomorrow, and that is when Melanchthon tried to translate the Augsburg Confession for the Greek Orthodox Church, translated from Latin and German into Greek, he didn't talk about justification by faith or justification by grace, because the Eastern wouldn't understand it. He said, sanctified by grace. Now, they didn't respond to that because they recognized that the Lutherans were really Catholics, Western Catholics, anyhow, and that Luther's and Melanchthon's attempt to get the Orthodox on their side was a political maneuver, not a theological maneuver. And so the Lutherans didn't start talking until after World War II with the Orthodox. But Melanchthon had a vision, that he knew a little bit about it, that it was the grace of God, not the laws of man or church, that sanctified and made holy the family of God. And I can close with justice. A couple of sentences here from one of the professors at Gettysburg. I think I'll just read it and then you can have some questions, because tomorrow we're going to deal with the whole business of mysteries anyhow. It was very significant for the Lutheran movement to reject the medieval materialistic understanding of the sacraments, that they are holy substances, as well as the left-wing Schwärmerei, whose spiritualistic notion of the subordination of the sacraments to preaching, that the sacraments are only ceremonies, should be omitted. But when the movement shifted the argument from polemics to edification, the significance of the sacraments as visible word was asserted. What a sacrament says and what it does is not two things but one thing. That's why Melanchthon defined the sacraments as signs and testimonies of God's will toward us for the purpose of awakening and strengthening our faith. Article 13 in the Augsburg Confession. Sacraments should be so used that faith, which believes the promises that are set forth and offered, is added. Melanchthon seems especially concerned to avoid the medieval rivalry, which still goes on in the Lutherans, between word and sacrament by using the Augustinian definition of the sacrament as the visible word. And with that I close, because we're going to deal with all kinds of sacraments tomorrow, but especially foot washing. We're a little over time, but do you have a couple of questions or responses?
Omar, what I'm thinking of about this infant communion as the practice of the early church, Congregatio Catechumenorum de Missa est. Now, you didn't refer to that.
Right. Say it in English, what, they say.
Well, the congregation of the catechumens is dismissed. That's where you get the word mass.
Mm-hmm.
Does that throw no light upon what practice we should have today with regard to whom we should commune and what we should do before we commune?
I'm asking you a question. You act like you're an antiquarian, Ed, but that is late 6th, 7th century West. And that was when they were beginning to start what finalized in the Middle Ages.
Wasn't that earlier than that?
No. It's not in the early church. Not in the early church at all. The families were there. The people who were brought in and baptized as a family. If you were baptized, you see, you've got to remember that the catechumen that you're talking about is the adult who has not been baptized. So they didn't dismiss baptized people. A baptized person wasn't a catechumen. You follow what the logic?
Yeah.
If they were baptized, they were already there and weren't dismissed. It was the pagan, Greek, German, Polish, Norwegian, who hadn't yet been baptized, who was in the catechism class.
You could hardly conceive, though, of a family where the children had been baptized and the parents hadn't, could you?
Very, very seldom, right. That's why I'm saying they didn't dismiss children, because the children and the parents had been baptized. Does that make sense to you, Ed? You look puzzled.
Yeah.
I sometimes think theological, you people have studied, so I'm listening to you. It's most interesting. We as lay people, coming to communion, we go for the strength,
right,
the faith to strengthen our faith.
Exactly.
And sometimes this, all of a sudden I think, well, maybe I shouldn't go. Maybe it's of no value. Just forget it. And I think this is sometimes where we harm the lay person.
Exactly.
You got to be a little careful.
So we don't have so many rules and laws and theology
right
about it.
Right. But Christ, when he instituted, told us to come and remember. I don't believe that it saves us, It's only by faith. Because the people on the cross neither could be baptized nor could he go to communion.
Mm-hmm.
So we
right
do see it like this. But as I listened, I was most interested. But you go so far ahead of us that all of a sudden you think, And then I come back to the fact of that grace of God with my small believing.
That's the basic issue right there. In other words, it's the grace of God. It's his table. It's not some ecumenical theologian's table. It's not some priest's table. It's not some constitution of a congregation's table. It's Jesus' table. It's his grace, his renewal, or the Orthodox would say, it's his new life that he's giving you. And I think that's so much simpler. If I were dealing with one of my lectures on what is heresy, you'd discover that the Greek Orthodox Church does not believe in rational heresy. And yet that's all Lutherans ever talk about, the thing that gets you confused.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, we get in all these rational things, highfalutin notions.
It's kind of a shame.
Right, it is a shame that we can't, Joe. And if you can come, and I'm not going to guess your age, if you can come at your age in a childlike faith for the grace of God, a child can do the same. Doesn't need all this spinning of stuff that the Lutherans and the Catholics and even Wolf was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for that. Yes?
How about an unbaptized adult coming to communion, receiving communion?
Okay.
It's happened in our church. A lot of the relatives of this particular person was quite deeply concerned. The pastor isn't aware yet.
I don't want to give an out-and-out answer because that's one of those things that I mentioned earlier. That's a pastoral opportunity. It's a pastoral opportunity rather than saying this is a legalistic decision. You know, my feeling is that baptized people of all ages should be welcome to communion. We haven't talked about the issue who should be kept out of communion, which is a whole other ball of wax that could get us into all kinds of trouble. But traditionally we've said if you're not baptized, you can't come. But if somebody feels a need, who is what the Greeks would call an incipient Christian, or what Lutherans sometimes call a hidden Christian, didn't know they were Christian, if they come, then the pastoral follow-up has to decide where you go with that. It's not a sin for that person to come. It's not a sin for the pastor to have given communion, or for the elder, if they were distributing, to have given communion. It's an opportunity for recognizing that individual's need, and for the pastor to then talk about what did this mean? What was the reason? Would you like to be baptized? You know, that's the kind of thing that happened to the Ethiopian on the way to the south from Jerusalem, you know. I might want to be baptized. What's to hinder me from having communion? That's the kind of thing. I can't give you an out-and-out answer on that one. I think it's pastoral. Yes?
Just a comment. First of all, I think it's great that we can meet today and talk about the Eastern Church. Over a third of the Christian world is Eastern Orthodox, and we know so little about them. I've attended Divine Liturgy several times, but I've never seen a baptism. Is the baby immersed into the font three times? And then I want to ask, when the baby is communed, right after baptism, is the communion, has it been reserved, or does it take place later on during the Divine Liturgy and they give it to the baby then, or is the baby communed right after baptism?
Okay, the baptism itself is by immersion in a font, but not in a deep. Now, the Byzantine Church, they had the three steps that you walk down in, and the conch shell was poured over you.
And the baby's naked, right?
And the baby's naked, yeah. And dipped into a larger baptismal font than we had in any of the churches I've ever served. But it is enough to dip in, and they do three times. They don't worry about the stuff Baptists get hung up on, whether it's front side up or back side up or what it is. They don't worry about that baptism, and then the sign of the cross. Now, the communion follows immediately in the service. See, baptism is done, Ed, in the narthex, in the entrance way of the church. Sometimes it was in a separate building outside the church. But immediately after the baptism, you go into the Divine Liturgy. And that's when the child is communed. It's not communed at the baptismal fonts. They don't reserve the host. There is no such thing as a reserved host in the Orthodox Church or the non-Chalcedonian, non-Orthodox Eastern Churches. Does that briefly answer the question?
I know of one Lutheran church where the baptismal font is in the narthex. When a child is baptized, you turn around and look there. It's the sacrament of initiation.
Many are doing it that way now, the entrance into the church, and it's symbolized by being in the narthex. One last thing is that, you know, here we had the option Sunday night, those of you who are here, of having communion by intinction. First time I used intinction in my church in Toledo 20 years or so ago, people had two reactions to it. One, this is terrible, I don't understand it, it doesn't mean anything to me. And others had the reaction, this is the most meaningful experience of communion I've ever had. Because in a way, I wasn't being communed by a priest or an elder, I was communing myself. And they saw that symbolism in it, and the unity. So you don't break the unity. You also get away from the the issue of whether you're going to have common cup or glasses, and that's a false issue all the way around, because there's nothing in the Bible, in spite of all these liturgical people who've said anything about it, there's nothing in the Bible that says there was only one cup passed around those guys in the upper room. Jesus took the cup and he blessed it. Nothing says he passed it around. There were four other cups in everybody's plate. They might have all risen like we do and say skål. We might have all had our own cup, or he might have passed it. There's no way of proving that it was one cup in the Bible. He took his cup. Later on, the common cup and the common loaf was traditional. That would, we got it, that's clear. But we don't have any proof that one cup was circulated around that room. Absolutely no way to do it.
He said, drink ye all.
Right. And the all refers to all of the people gathered around. It doesn't mean you got to drink it all. That's right. That's right. Some of us think that that's what it means, pass around. But we're all going to